Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, thousands of Palestinians, including around 500 administrative detainees, are behind bars in Israeli jails. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and death of civilians, especially children. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Batinga Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Sanctions Caused Mass Civilian Deaths in Iraq. Afghan civilians are up next. Stay tuned, please. 1 million Afghan children may die from starvation over the next several months, according to the United Nations. Nearly 23 million Afghans are facing crisis levels of hunger and 8.7 million are on the brink of starvation. This mass hunger has rendered millions of Afghans on the verge of death, according to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Alongside looming mass starvation, Afghans face below-freezing temperatures, severe shortages of life-saving medical supplies, and extreme poverty, making conditions in Afghanistan among the gravest of human rights crises on Earth. This is not a natural disaster, nor is it the result of conflict internal to Afghanistan. This is a human-made humanitarian catastrophe, United States-made specifically. The U.S.-allied Afghan government, most recently under the rule of Ashraf Ghani, was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Following the Taliban takeover in mid-August 2021, the Biden administration and the U.N. Security Council instituted devastating sanctions, sharply reducing foreign aid. The Biden administration froze $9.5 billion worth of Afghanistan's foreign currency reserves, roughly equivalent to 40% of the country's gross domestic product. Journalist Ryan Grimm and Sarah Sirota recently reported that the White House has urged European partners and multilateral institutions like the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to similarly starve the nation of capital. This has led to the total collapse of Afghanistan's economy, creating an almost globally unprecedented level of economic shock. Unemployment has skyrocketed, and the country's healthcare infrastructure has been decimated. As experts have noted, more Afghans are poised to die from U.S. sanctions over the next few months alone than have died at the hands of the U.S. military forces over the last 20 years combined by a significant margin. Yet, as journalist Murtaza Hussein recently wrote, U.S. establishment politicians and intellectuals who decried the humanitarian crisis during the fall of Kabul are seemingly unbothered by imminent mass starvation imposed by the U.S. The Biden administration is ignoring desperate pleas from humanitarian organizations and UN human rights bodies, choosing instead to maintain policies virtually guaranteed to cause mass starvation and death of civilians, especially children. Yet it is important to note and remember that as a member and matter of policy, this is not particularly new. The U.S. has often imposed harsh economic sanctions, causing mass civilian death. A previous imposition of sanctions resulted in one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes, one largely forgotten in mainstream historical memory. In 1990, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iraq through the UN following the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. These sanctions continued for more than a decade after Iraq withdrew from Kuwait and had horrific humanitarian consequences, eerily similar to the imminent mass starvation of Afghan civilians. The sanctions regime against Iraq, which began under George H.W. Bush, but was primarily administered by Bill Clinton's administration, froze Iraq's foreign assets, virtually banned trade, and sharply limited reports. These sanctions crashed the Iraqi economy and blocked the import of humanitarian supplies, medicine, food, and other basic necessities, killing scores of civilians. The international diplomat, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, and former Finnish president, Martti ICRE led the first UN delegation to Iraq shortly after the imposition of sanctions. The delegation reported that nothing that we had seen or read had quite prepared us for the particular form of devastation which has now befallen the country, unquote. The sanctions had produced near apocalyptic results. 2 years later, the World Food Program reported that the continuing sanctions had virtually paralyzed the whole economy and generated persistent deprivation, chronic hunger, endemic undernutrition, massive unemployment, and widespread human suffering. A grave humanitarian tragedy is unfolding, unquote. The consequences of the sanctions for Iraq's healthcare system were dramatic. Journalist Jeremy Schill extensively covered Iraq under these sanctions and reported that every pediatric hospital felt like a death row for infants. Highly trained Iraqi doctors had the knowledge to save these infants, but the sanctions blocked them from acquiring basic medical supplies and pharmaceuticals, forcing doctors to reuse syringes multiple times and ultimately watch children die of perfectly treatable ailments. Iraqi hospitals reeked of gasoline, Schill recalled, since desperate doctors were forced to substitute gasoline for sterilizer, disinfectant, and bleach. UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq, Dennis Halliday, resigned his post in protest of the sanctions after serving as a UN diplomat for more than 30 years. During his resignation, he told the press that 4,000 to 5,000 children are dying unnecessarily every month due to the impact of sanctions because of the breakdown of water and sanitation, inadequate diet, and the bad internal health situation. He went on to label the U.S.-imposed sanctions as genocide. His successor, German diplomat Hans von Sponeck, also resigned in protest after fewer than 2 years, calling the sanctions a true human tragedy that needs to be ended. A report by the UN Commission on Human Rights studying the impact of the sanctions on Iraq estimated the civilian death toll to be in the range from 500,000 to 1.5 million, with the majority of the dead being children. Clinton Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was confronted with this shocking statistic on 60 Minutes, which led to this now infamous exchange. During this era of sanctions, then Senator Joe Biden was a member and eventually chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Biden strongly supported sanctions and advocated for even more aggressive policies toward Iraq. Biden was not then and is not now known for his humanitarian impulses or dovish foreign policy stances. The same cannot be said for Samantha Power. Power is the current head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, who was brought into the Biden administration to be a champion of human rights, lifting up the vulnerable and ushering in a new era of human progress and development, according to Biden's nomination statement. Power was the founding director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, served as the Obama administration's UN ambassador, and has a long list of human rights accolades. The nomination of this human rights crusader, as Politico put it, was widely praised in the human rights community, yet Power's record on U.S.-imposed sanctions, first in scholarship and then practice, is abysmal. In her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide describes the U.S. response to genocides of the 20th century, arguing that U.S. power should have been used to prevent atrocities and protect civilians. In the chapter surveying the 1990s, Power condemns the Clinton administration's failure to intervene in Rwanda, intervene soon enough in the Balkans, and use U.S. military force to curb atrocities elsewhere. Yet the U.S. sanctions regime that caused mass devastation to Iraqi civilians was conspicuously absent. It does not get a single mention in the book. Power's silence on the hundreds of thousands of children dead from U.S. sanctions is telling. Power is unrelenting, and rightfully so, in her condemnation of human rights abuses carried out by other countries. Yet even though the death toll of the U.S.-imposed sanctions rivaled or even exceeded the contemporaneous atrocities and genocides Power depicted in her book, when the U.S. was the perpetrator, she was silent. Unfortunately, her silence on sanctions and their devastating human consequences persist. Power, as administrator of USAID, is now an active participant in the starvation of Afghan civilians. In response to the pleas from the UN and humanitarian organizations working in Afghanistan, USAID increased humanitarian aid. But, as experts have noted, meagerly increasing aid while imposing devastating sanctions and freezing nearly all of Afghanistan's foreign assets will do nearly nothing to stop the unprecedented level of economic shock. There is near consensus among numerous humanitarian coordinators that the only way to curb the collapse of Afghanistan's economy and prevent furthering the major humanitarian disaster already underway is to lift the sanctions. Unfortunately, Power, the so-called defender of human rights, refuses to call for a lifting of the sanctions and instead remains uncritical. The devastating human toll of sanctions on Iraqi civilians in the 90s is a grim warning for what lies ahead if current U.S. policy continues. The Clinton administration sanctions caused mass deaths and suffering, and the Biden administration is dangerously close to falling in their footsteps. The human rights hawks, who lamented the humanitarian consequences of the fall of Kabul, are now silent in the face of U.S.-imposed mass starvation, and the human rights crusader within the administration is complicit. We must listen to the chorus of humanitarian organizations and pressure the Biden administration to immediately lift the sanctions before it is too late. Afghans have suffered at the hands of U.S. for long enough.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. Tensions are simmering in the occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli forces attack Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. More than 150 Palestinians were injured and another 400 arrested in the attack. Following the raid, thousands of Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip also took to the streets in solidarity with the worshippers. Officials from the resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad condemned the attack, pledging to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. Israeli regime has intensified their crackdown across the occupied West Bank, killing over a dozen Palestinians since April the 10th. Palestinians have ramped up retaliatory attacks against Israeli forces in recent weeks, an indication that Palestinians remain determined to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation and the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and some Arab governments. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have author and researcher Daniel Yegich, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And also journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes is joining us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Yegich in Beirut. How do you view the recent wave of violence against Palestinians carried out by the Israeli regime against worshippers during the holy month of Ramadan and at the much revered Al-Aqsa Mosque?
I mean, the latest wave of violence is another form, another manifestation of Israeli state terrorism that the Israeli apartheid regime has been using to oppress Palestinians in many ways, and in particular, of course, on religious holidays. This has been a systematic part and parcel of the Israeli occupation regime for decades now, where they would attack Palestinians in holy places on particular holidays, just out of mere hatred, driven by the hatred for Palestinians, for their religion, and for their mere freedom and humanity. And the latest pictures and videos that we've seen from today just show once again the brutality of the Israeli terror regime that has dehumanized Palestinians to an extent that it just uses all sorts of weapons against defenseless people in order to terrorize them. But I think it also shows the weakness of the Zionist regime, because this is a war that the colonizer cannot win. Palestinians are still there. Palestinians do go to their holy places on holidays to worship. And I think this also shows the fragility of the Israeli project, because it reminds the colonizer that the colonized population, the indigenous population, still adheres to their traditions and religions and lives their culture despite this terror regime that the Israelis have been developing to a very high and sophisticated degree over for more than seven decades now.
Fra Hughes, there were a number of reprisal attacks against Israelis, some even in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these recent events as Palestinians are venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
I think what we're witnessing is a direct response to the violence and the cowardly brutality being visited upon the Palestinian people in Al-Aqsa, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied territories. So I think with every action, there is a reaction, and the reaction from people who have been militarily oppressed, beaten, jailed, had their houses bulldozed, had their land confiscated, had their water stolen, their lives and their dreams, is to prove to the Israeli government and wider Israeli society that they are not safe in Tel Aviv. They are not safe in anywhere in historic 48 Palestine. People believe, I think, in Israeli society that all the violence and the threat of violence from Palestinians is limited to both Gaza and to the West Bank. But forms of resistance that are found on the state of Israel itself proves that there is nowhere to hide. There is no safe place for Israelis who go to the West Bank and brutalize the indigenous population. who bomb Gaza from the air and from the sea and from the land and think that they are safe in their homes and in their clubs and in their places of work in Tel Aviv and in all of occupied 48 Palestine.
Sure, Mr. Yegich, Hamas has pledged to defend al-Assad at any price. Islamic Jihad described the attack as a crime and said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its aggression. The PA also reacted too, saying that aggression against al-Assad is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Summing up all of that, observers and analysts say we could be looking at the prelude of a third intifada. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, especially if you look into the situation that we had approximately a year ago, it was quite similar with the the holy month of Ramadan and the Easter celebrations being overshadowed by Israeli attacks on worshippers in Al-Quds and other places in Palestine, which has triggered a very strong response from the Palestinian resistance. So in many ways, there are parallels between the situation today and the way it was a year ago. And again, I mean, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves with all means at their disposal against this terror regime. And the Israeli regime cannot think that any settler should feel safe at any point, given that their presence on the stolen indigenous land in itself is a violation of Palestinian rights. And I think it is, I mean, there are different episodes of so-called escalations of violence, but effectively there's a structural violence that Palestinians do resist against in their daily lives, sometimes just by merely existing, which already for the settler colonial regime, the existence and survival of the indigenous people is a form of threat and violence. Now, when it comes to the question of armed resistance, of course, there might be Palestinian responses. And again, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves that is enshrined in international law, UN resolutions, but even beyond that, I mean, I'm mentioning international law, but still there are no international mechanisms that would protect Palestinians from Israeli violations of this law. But of course, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves. And depending on, of course, how the situation evolves in the next days, we may see more more of the such reactions potentially.
Farah Hughes, let's talk about the normalization deals. As the Israelis expand ties with Arab governments, grassroots Palestinian reactions are increasing. Is this a clear sign from Palestinians showing how they feel about these deals, about Israel trying to legitimize the occupation through these U.S.-crafted normalization deals?
Well, I think what you have is the United States and Israel are trying to create like a coalition of the willing within West Asia, with potentially the idea behind this that there might be some form of a unified army across some of these countries, like the United Arab Emirates, like Saudi Arabia, working in conjunction and on behalf of Zionism and Western imperialist interests within the region. I think what's happening on the ground in Palestine is it directly correlated to what's happening in the wider political sphere within the region. But I think from the Israeli terrorism that we're seeing at present, this is a form of total control over the occupied territories and the people within it. So the tighter they turn the screw of repression, the more Palestinian resistance and the Palestinians will filter through the clenched fist of the Israeli military occupation, because those people are resisting the very fact that Israel tries to control residential permits, work permits, the right of movement, the right of access across borders, the right to medicine, the right to healthcare, the right to education. So I think Palestinians will continue to resist. I think the Zionist forces will continue their attack upon Al-Aqsa Mosque, because I believe that there is a determination there to eventually turn the Al-Aqsa Mosque into a second Ibrahim Mosque in Hebron, where you will find that the Israeli Zionist religious settlers more and more violating the holy sanctuary of the mosque, with the intention of someday taking total control of the mosque, which is why we see such valiant resistance from men, women, and children in Al-Quds and further afield to defy the Israeli Zionist machine from totally dominating their lives.
All right, Mr. Yegich, Palestinians have condemned the agreements, these normalization agreements, as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. Iran has strongly condemned the Israeli attacks at Al-Aqsa Mosque, saying that the regime has become more aggressive as a result of some Arab rulers abandoning the Palestinians and their cause. Do you think that these Arab governments have effectively turned a blind eye to the suffering of their Arab brethren, and that has also emboldened the Israeli regime even more?
Yes, I do think so. These Arab regimes that have normalized their ties with the Israeli regime have, of course, even before the normalization, not really cared about the struggle for liberation of Palestine. The Palestinian struggle is rooted in the idea of liberation, of freedom, of resisting decolonization and freeing the land. And this has a lot of support amongst Arab states, amongst populations, and beyond the Arab states. In the Third World, in the Global South, and even in the West, Palestinians do enjoy support by many people. Now, what we see in the Arab regimes in the Persian Gulf is that there are dictatorships that are absolutist monarchies, are not elected by their populations, so they don't have the legitimate not representing democratically their populations. And many of these regimes themselves are, having to find ways to manifest their and consolidate their power. So they're in many ways natural allies to the Israeli regime. Now, when it comes to the issue of Palestine, of course, this has never been a major issue for these regimes. And in fact, having a military and so-called security and surveillance cooperation with the Israeli regime strengthens their own legitimacy somehow, or at least their position geopolitically, as well as their ties to the United States. But I think that the normalization agreements have made this the circumstances are quite obvious, very official to an extent that Palestinians do not have to expect any sort of solidarity from these regimes. And yes, I do think that this has somehow strengthened the Israeli regime, because now it does enjoy backing from several Arab countries in its terrorism against the Palestinian population.
Frau Hughes, let's talk about the international response. We do see a clear double standard when countries that are quick to condemn, for example, Hamas retaliatory missile strikes, that was the case last year around the same time, those very countries are silent during forcible takeovers of homes, brutal suppression of demonstrators, and when places of worship come under assault, like today when Israeli forces desecrate the Al-Aqsa Mosque. How do you view this inconsistency?
Well, I'd say, firstly, the attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque are, they're not unprecedented, because we've seen it several times before, but they're maybe unprecedented in the world political sphere. It's not often that a government gets to go into a place of worship, brutalize the worshippers, fire tear gas and open fire with live bullets. I think the hypocrisy you're seeing from the West is nothing new. Israel is a European Zionist colonial project within West Asia. It has the backing first of Britain, more recently of America. It has the EU giving it political cover and the fig leaf that allows this brutality to go on day and daily. We in the West are bombarded 24/7 by propaganda, which is in the interest of Zionism. It's in the interest of Western imperialism. It's in the interest of the European Union, because that is what we see. We see European televised news. We see European press news. We see and read and listen to the radio and the newspapers. So the first casualty of war is truth. But, I mean, the second casualty is obviously propaganda that we are suffering from day and daily. And just briefly, if you look at what's happening in Ukraine and compare it to the coverage of what's happening inside Jerusalem and inside Palestine, we see the leader of Ukraine, President Zelensky, to make Ukraine a new Israel within Europe. So I think what we are going to have, and what it proves, is that the fascism in Ukraine is mirrored by the fascism within Israel itself. And this is why there is a dichotomy and a divergence of the coverage of different conflicts. And the Palestinians are abandoned because the West wants Israel to succeed, and it wants the Arab nations and the Arab region to stay under American hegemony and European political control.
Danny Yegich, Mr. Hughes brought up the issue of Ukraine. Can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation against Palestine?
Yeah, I think if we compare the reactions from the so-called international community to what is happening in Ukraine right now and what's been happening in Palestine for about a century now, we can draw the conclusion that this is a manifestation of hypocrisy and white supremacy. When it comes to the media coverage, as well as political statements around Ukraine, this has been a central focus for the so-called international community. Also here, oftentimes when we refer to the international community, it is oftentimes Western Europe, North America, and other settler colonies, while the majority of the world's population is excluded oftentimes from the dominant implications of this term. And so within this hegemonic discourse, Ukraine has been at the center. We've seen Western political leaders as well as mainstream media commending the Ukrainian civilians who are taking up arms to fight against Russia. We've seen clear support for Ukraine's right to defend itself, for armed so-called resistance, whereas, of course, in the case of Palestine, this is oftentimes in advance and generalized and condemned as forms of terrorism. Now, of course, again, there are many similarities between Ukraine and Israel. An Israeli project, but effectively, I mean, Israel is a European settler colony, a European outpost in Western Asia, and enjoys the backing of the European Union. It's part of European identity. This is why, again, yet today, with the latest, very well audiovisually, very well documented instances of state terrorism by the Zionist regime against defenseless Palestinians, European Union bureaucrats came out again with the same old statements that they bring up, claiming that they are concerned. They're urging all sides to de-escalate, that there is no room for extremism, and so on, using euphemisms and downplaying the violence of the Israeli regime that the Israeli regime perpetuates so clearly and visibly. So to that extent, the European Union is actually doing propaganda and public diplomacy work on behalf of the Israeli regime, and is as such deeply complicit, of course, also in many different ways in terms of arming the settler colony and providing it with support. But I think this is just one of the many ways in which we see this hypocrisy and, again, the centrality of this white supremacist Eurocentric ideals when it comes to the representation of Palestine and Ukraine.
Farah Hughes, final thoughts from you. The Israeli racism and brutality has been evident enough that Human Rights Watch has in numerous reports labeled Israel's policies towards the Palestinians as apartheid. But apartheid needs international action. Need I not remind anyone of South Africa? So when will we see this international action? And what more does the world need to see and hear?
Sadly, I'm not sure we will ever see that international action. As someone who lives in the West, as someone who lives in Ireland, what I see in general is that the people of the West, and indeed the southern global south, the people are with the Palestinians, but the government, the elite, the corporations, and the people who have power and influence are very much with the Zionists. So it's going to take the BDS movement, it's going to take people like me, people like our friends in Beirut, people like our friends all over the European continent, South America and Africa, to come together and demand justice and dignity for the people of Palestine, and to demand an end to the Israeli Zionist barbaric apartheid repressive brutality which is visited day and daily upon the Palestinian people. So unless there is a huge groundswell from members of the public, the working class people all over the world, sadly I do not see there being any pressure put on the Zionist regime it is more likely that it will be the Palestinians within historic Palestine, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank who will eventually put enough pressure upon the military regime within the Zionist government in order to force some form of a democratic settlement with equality for all the people within the region. But sadly, I don't see it happening anytime soon.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Author and researcher Daniel Yegich joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Journalist, author, and activist Frog Hughes joining us from Belfast. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A recent study by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco found that more than 2 million fentanyl-filled fake pills were seized by U.S. law enforcement agencies in the last quarter of 2021 alone, an indication of how common they have become in the nation's illicit drug supply. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Erin McCormick titled U.S. Teen Overdose Deaths Double in 3 Years Amid Fentanyl Crisis. Stay tuned for more. A new study has found drug overdose deaths among high school-aged U.S. teens have more than doubled since 2019, driven by a rise in the deadly opioid fentanyl. Researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, who analyzed mortality rates among 14 to 18-year-olds over the past decade, found that while drug use among this age group is actually falling, fatalities are on the rise, jumping from 492 in 2019 to 954 in 2020, then climbing to 1,146 in 2021. Researchers attribute this to a flood of counterfeit pills, which look exactly like real oxycodone or Xanax tablets, but actually contain fentanyl, a synthetic opioid so potent that one counterfeit pill can prove fatal. Vast quantities of these fake pills are being smuggled into the country and are circulating in the illicit drug market, meaning that teens often ingest the deadly drug unknowingly. Joseph Friedman, who led the study published on April 12th in JAMA, said, "We are seeing really young kids start to die because the illicit drug supply has become extremely toxic." The study found that the rates of drug deaths are highest among indigenous and Hispanic teens, but that young people of all races are affected. Friedman said it's scary stuff, adding the deaths represented the major first overdose spike seen in adolescence since tracking began. Teens are continuing to experiment with pills. The pills are just getting much more deadly. A recent study by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco found that more than 2 million fentanyl-filled fake pills were seized by law enforcement agencies in the last quarter of 2021 alone, an indication of how common they have become in the nation's illicit drug supply. The UCLA study cited survey data showing that the number of 10th graders reporting having used drugs in the past year held the steady at about 30% between 2010 and 2020 and then dropped to only 18% during 2021 as the pandemic stretched on. Morgan Godwin, a Portland, Oregon-based drug addiction researcher and co-author of the study, said, "A really important fact here is that more kids are not doing drugs," adding, "The drugs they are doing are just incredibly more lethal." The study comes at a time when the number of overdose deaths in the U.S. has exploded to more than 100,000 a year due to the huge amounts of fentanyl and other synthetic opioids saturating the country's drug supply. Fentanyl is as much as 100 times more potent than morphine. Friedman said these counterfeit pills are spreading across the nation and teens may not realize they are dangerous. The researchers said while many adult users may know the pills they are buying on the street markets actually contain fentanyl, youth most likely believe they are getting genuine pharmaceuticals. Godwin said kids think that pills are very safe, adding, because while they might not have been prescribed to them, they were supposedly prescribed to someone, and young people believe the purity does not vary. In reality, though, the opioid dosages in counterfeit pills can vary dramatically. The Drug Enforcement Administration estimates that 4 in 10 seized pills contain potentially lethal doses. The authors call for more drug education in schools, giving kids realistic information about how to protect themselves from fentanyl. Friedman said high school might be too late, adding, "We need to include information about drugs on the street in school even earlier." The researchers said youth should also be given education about and access to Narcan, the overdose reversal drug, which can revive someone who has overdosed, and fentanyl test strips, which can detect counterfeit pills. Researchers and youth advocacy groups say teens are often easily able to obtain the pills from friends or from local dealers who offer them on social media apps like Snapchat or Instagram and sometimes deliver them straight to teenagers' homes. Guardian interviews with families that lost teenagers to accidental overdoses from fentanyl pills show that it can happen to anyone. In February 2021, Sammy Berman Chapman, a 16-year-old straight student and the son of the television trappist Laura Berman, died in his bedroom in Los Angeles after taking what he thought was single Xanax. In Arizona in 2020, Zach Plunk, a 17-year-old star high school running back, died after taking one tablet, labeled to look just like a pharmaceutical M30 oxycodone pill. In both cases, the tablets bought over social media turned out to be deadly doses of fentanyl. Snapchat recently announced increased measures to combat drug dealing on the platform, while Instagram has said the company works to remove such content. Plunk's mother, Wendy Plunk, said it's just so sickening, adding there is still not enough being done to stop kids from getting the fake pills over social media sites and to warn them about the danger. She said we need to get the word out. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 100,000 people died from overdoses in the U.S. in a 12-month period ending in April 2021. Drug researchers say it's the biggest increase ever seen in the U.S., and it's only rising each month. Nora Volko, director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, told The Guardian fentanyl is driving the majority of those deaths, associated with at least 60% of the fatal overdoses, a 50% increase in a single year. She said it's devastating, adding it's an epidemic within the pandemic. Deaths from fentanyl were already on the rise across the country, but the pandemic supercharged their speed and intensity. Volko said it's not unusual to see people turn to drugs or alcohol during times of crisis, adding, but what we didn't expect was that during that period, there will be a massive increase in the entry of these illicit substances into the country. Dramatically more fentanyl is coming into the U.S., making the drug supply increasingly dangerous. Daniel Sicaron, the Justice Minor Endowed Professor of Addiction Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, said, the trajectory is up with no leveling off, adding there is nothing that says it's slowing down. He said a triple wave of opioids from pain pills to heroin to fentanyl is wreaking havoc. Another alarming trend is rising with the dominance of fentanyl. People who have never used opioids before are dying from single fatal encounter with fentanyl. Volko said they are not opioid users and they don't know that these drugs are contaminated and they die with one single exposure. Even for those who are accustomed to taking opioids, it can be difficult to judge a safe dosage of fentanyl. Most experienced drug users don't prefer it, but as prescription pills and heroin became harder to get, dealers have increasingly begun mixing fentanyl into the supply. Experts and grieving families are seeing alarming numbers of people, even children, taking what they think are legitimate Percocet or Xanax pills with friends.